All right, hey guys, welcome to episode number 119 of the Three Drinks In podcast. I am your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. In this episode, we are talking about Mission Impossible 6, is it now? 6. Fallout, with our special guest, Alec Baldwin, when he shows up, eventually. Just before we do that, though, Three Drinks In is available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radios. Just search for Three Drinks In Podcast. You'll easily find us. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Three Drinks In Pod. That's at the number 3, Drinks In Pod. Like us on Facebook and email us, threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. That's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Cavill and his, what do they call it, reloading?
Gotta reload his guns.
It's become such a thing. It's hilarious. Junk, junk. And then, of course, I couldn't but see the pocket.
Yeah.
The pocket was extremely distracting. I'm like, wait for it. There it is. The pocket.
Yeah. Pretty odd.
Yeah. Editing. I mean, they must have done 1,000 takes of that scene. It probably took them better end of a week to shoot. I mean, they broke everything in there.
Yeah, they did.
So whenever you throw that little Asian guy through something, that isn't the first time that they've done that.
Yeah.
So they really have to stop, pick up the Asian guy, reassemble him, and then put the wall back together. And then that's how that goes. All right, waiting for Alec Baldwin to show up. Obviously,
probably scream at us.
Yeah. He's actually very, very funny, though, as much of a jerk. And my wife's met him before. She spent the better end of an evening with him. She was like doing some kind of a charity event for a theater company in New York. And it was like a bowling event. That was the thing. And so she had to go and kind of be the assistant, the gopher for this one group of bowlers, and that included Alec Baldwin. And she spent most of the night trying to find a bowling ball that would fit his massive hands. So, but she had a few very nice things to say about his personality.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows? I will say that when I saw him on that Jerry Seinfeld show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, they were talking about that Ken Burns documentary about the Vietnam War. And I wanted to watch that, but, like, you know, I don't have a lot of time in my day. And so I would watch something like that when my wife's asleep and you're just laying in bed. But, like, you know, when you're sitting there and all of a sudden they cut to some guy with a machine gun blasting away, like, that's not bedtime type TV show watching. And he said that, and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly why I haven't watched this yet, because I'm just going to wake up my wife with all the Harrier jets and the machine guns and what have you.
Yeah. You don't watch Band of Brothers before you go to bed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's depressing, but it's also going to jolt you awake.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it's a war story. So
you have a beer today?
No, I don't. I had one last time.
I know, and I didn't, so now we've switched.
Thanks for noticing last time when I had a beer.
Oh.
Sarcasm.
I didn't really care that much. I
noticed you don't care unless it's you.
It's true. It's true. It's mostly true about most things. Mm-hmm. I have the Founders All Day IPA Session Ale. Well, it's the listener. It's them we're here for.
Oh, yes. Is it good?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, good. Drink more beer.
So, that's good. Yeah, just waiting for Mr. Baldwin.
So, this is the 6th movie.
Mm-hmm. The first one came out 22 years ago.
Why did they stop giving them numbers?
I think that's a general trend. in filmmaking today. Like, you don't see a lot of part twos. Like, I think they got away with it with Guardians of the Galaxy because of the riff on the tape that he listens to. Mm-hmm. This was volume two. But for the most part, like, can you think of a movie in the last few years that's had a, like a numbered sequel to it? Like, it's always The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, I mean, Iron Man did, but the third Iron Man.
That's true. Iron Man did. That.
Was Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
I think that's it, though. Godfather Part 2.
Yeah, they kind of stopped doing that, which is fine. It's, I think, because sequels are such, I mean, they are, they're horrors movies. That's really, that's such a great way of looking at it, even though it's a little harsh.
I don't really think that's accurate anymore. But that might have been in the late 70s, but that doesn't really hold up today.
Just because it's prevalent doesn't necessarily mean it's not necessarily a cash grab. I mean, Marvel's gotten good at finding a way to make sequels to seem less cash grabby, but they are still essentially cash grabs. I mean, we've said it like a thousand times. Most of the best Marvel movies, with a few exceptions, have been the initial versions of a character. Iron Man 1, you know, certainly better than the other two. Thor, the first one was better.
Yeah, you're still telling a story versus like Jaws 2 and 3 and 4, where those are literally just, do you want to see a shark eat more people? Then that's what that, like, that's different.
Oh.
Like the, you know, those kinds of films. But, you know, the Godfather Part 2, there's more story there.
Yeah, no, there's there's definitely, you know, an uptick in quality as we've gotten better at this over the years. And The Godfather is a, you know, but even The Godfather suffers from the same problem as the rest of them. It's like, the first movie was your main story. The rest of this can be interesting, but you really did all you needed to do initially. You know, you can continue it, and Marvel's, you know, they're the only game in town when it comes to really quality sequels. I mean, the other exception might be The Dark Knight. But if they had never made Batman Begins, you could probably get away with just making The Dark Knight. Like,
yeah,
the character is sort of burned into our consciousness that we know who he is. We don't need a backstory for Batman. That's how they did the, you know, the one in 89. And people complained mostly that it was really a movie about the Joker and not about Batman, which everyone's like, which now we all go, well, yeah, because the villain is usually the more interesting guy in a movie like that. So they tried to, with Batman Begins, make this more about Batman to see what would drive a person to do it and how they would achieve that.
Well, what's interesting to me about the sequels not being numbered is that a lot of it is marketing, in that if you haven't seen the first five Mission Impossibles, let's say, we want you to still be able to come see this one. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that works because the story stands on its own, and sometimes it doesn't. So like, they just rebooted God of War and they did a great job, and they just called it God of War, even though it's really God of War 4. And I think you could get away with, like, I don't really need to know. I don't need to have played the other three to understand what's going on, because this is like totally new people, totally new setting. They talk about his past vaguely enough that you're like, okay, he was a bad guy and now he's trying to make up for that. But like, this movie is supposed to be the sort of the same thing. It's a new mission. He has a team that he trusts. We're not sure who the new guy is, but especially this one, there was so much in it that was like, I'm glad that I looked at Wikipedia the night before, because I couldn't remember what had happened. You know, like a lot of these stories where I was like, let's go see Mission Impossible. And like, if I had taken my wife, she'd have been totally lost. Like, okay, he's the bad guy, he's the good guy. But they're having all these moments where they're like, oh, remember that? Oh, I really hate that guy. Oh, he's really out to get me. You'd just be like, oh, why? Why does this weird, creepy guy hate him so much with the beard? You know?
Yeah, they definitely did more of a direct sequel for this one.
Yeah, so sometimes I wish they would just go with the numbering. But, you know, whatever, it changes.
Yeah.
So what did you think of Mission Impossible Fallout?
We had intended to do this like a few days ago when it was sort of fresher in my head, and now I'm sort of struggling to remember a lot. Like, it comes in flashes. I mean, people are really jumping up and down about this movie. And I'm sort of scratching my head. I'm like, the set pieces, like the action pieces in this, were good. Some of them were great. But it was fine, I guess. Like, there was nothing. It was certainly exciting, and yeah. I mean, it's fine. I mean, look, I don't think I like Christopher McQuarrie as a director. I think that, I mean, for those of you who don't know, he was the writer of what's that movie? The Usual Suspects. And he was a good friend of Bryan Singer's, and so when Bryan Singer went on to other things like Valkyrie, he would, you know, he wrote Valkyrie, and he's a really good director, a writer. He wrote Ghost Protocol, for example, and Brad Bird directed that, and then he got a chance to direct two of these movies, basically copying as much from Brad Bird as he possibly could, because I actually went back and watched 4 and 5 back to back, and, you know, Brad Bird's just a great action director, and like from the beginning of that movie, when like you're in, I think it's Budapest, and you're like the camera's just zooming in, very like it's kind of, it's like a helicopter shot. It's just like slowly boring down on one focal point in the city, and this, you know, the guy jumps out of the top of the roof and does that cool thing where he throws the parachute, like the big like mattress that, like that whole thing. It's like one giant, it seems like one long take. It's not. And then you go back and you watch 5, and you just, a lot of that same kind of stuff that McQuarrie does. Because, like, he's not an action director at all. And it's a really competent movie for a guy who's never directed an action movie before. You know, usually people who end up being really good action directors were previously editors, not writers. So I guess he's got a good, you know, director of photography and a good editor to help him kind of put all this stuff together. Because, it, you know, for a, not a novice guy, but a pretty novice, not a director type guy, it's pretty well executed. But he's gotten a hold of this franchise since Ghost Protocol, and they're, you know, for the most part, very good movies. They're very well executed, but they're just, there's nothing memorable about them. I mean, I think Ghost Protocol sticks in my head more because there was a few more clever bits in that one. And certainly with them, you know, they blew up the Kremlin. That was kind of a big, you know, geopolitical kind of thing that sticks in your brain. But for the most part, I don't know. I don't know if it's just like fatigue with 6 of these movies now. And Tom Cruise, who's never just seems to age. You know, you go back and you watch 1 and 2, and you can say, okay, yeah, he's a lot younger in those movies, you know. But now he's in his late 50s. And like, so somebody made a crack on the internet where like Tom Cruise is 10 years older than Wilford Brimley was when he was in The Fly. And like, the whole thing is that Wilford Brimley's been playing an old man since the early 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like Max von Sydow, who's been an old guy since the 70s.
Yeah.
But I mean, this was good. I enjoyed it. There were some things where I was just like, well, this is just stupid or annoying or kind of dumb. The whole Halo drop sequence, you know. But like right away, there's not a lot that sticks in my head that I can go, well, that was good. Like, we'll talk and it'll all come back to me. But for the most part, it's like, eh.
Okay. Yeah.
What do you think?
I thought the same. I thought it was everybody's been talking nonstop about the action. Yes, the action was fun to watch. It was interesting. Shot really well. But it feels very much like they came up with these ideas for action scenes and built a story around it.
That's exactly what they did. They don't even make any bones about that. They just say, this is what we want to do. Because this is what's going to up the ante and get everyone to come to the theater. What could you write me to go around that?
Yeah. And they had action sequences like that in the very first Mission Impossible. And they were good, but like, when I watched it when I was, you know, 11 or whatever, that's not really what stuck out to me. There was a lot of the subterfuge, and there was a lot of trying to figure things out. And he had a couple gadgets, you know, he had the mask that they always do, like a gimmick. And to me, that was a lot of it, that they were secret agents and spies, which is not what, like, James Bond does. James Bond is not a spy. He walks in with his face, tells everyone what his name is, or is the same drink everywhere. Like, that's not really what it is. But there's always been a team, and, like, how are we going to pull off a heist or switch somebody or kidnap them or protect them? Like, to me, that was always more interesting. Otherwise, I just watch an action movie. So Ghost Protocol had some really good scenes, even though they were trying to do sneaky things. And then the last two, it's just been like, what's the craziest thing we can get Tom Cruise to do? Or what's the craziest thing he wants to do? And then we'll talk him down one. Like, I want to do a Halo jump. Well, why don't we just do it real quick and short and quick cuts so we don't actually have to watch him do anything more insane?
I mean, they did do a Halo jump for this.
Oh, I know. He probably wanted to do it from, you know, he probably wanted to do 10 of them or something. Like with a gun while he was firing in the air or something crazy.
Right, well, let's refresh my memory as to what the hell was going on in this movie. So, yeah, I forget. What has it?
So the plot of this movie is that the guy from the last movie had an enormous amount of money and lots of secret agents, and their main goal was to just cause chaos everywhere, because they felt that bringing down governments and building them up again in their own image was going to be what saves humanity, whatever. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to be legitimately crazy. And this guy's in jail, and all of his followers stole plutonium. And Tom Cruise was pretending to be one specific person who was going to buy the plutonium for the other followers. And that's what sets up, like, trying to take the guy's place and then trying to get the guy out of jail, the main mastermind, and, you know.
Right. So they fail to get the plutonium for these people. And so he has to try to get the plutonium back from the bad guys. And the other bad guys are like, well, we want you to get the plutonium. We'll give you the plutonium if you get our leader out of jail.
Right.
Right, okay. And so then it's the first half of the film, it's about getting the guy out of the prison.
Yeah.
And all the while they're chasing some guy named John Lark, who's like...
Well, John Lark is supposed to be...
like the head apostle?
Yeah, so that's where I got a little confused, and I really tried to follow this. John Lark is like a head apostle kind of guy. All the other followers are called apostles. Tom Cruise imitates him because they supposedly killed a guy by mistake. And they're trying to buy the plutonium. And the price for that is their leader.
Right.
So they're willing to give up the plutonium or give up their own leader for it?
Right. So they... All right. See, this is the thing. It was sort of needlessly complicated. Like, it didn't need to be this weird. Looking back on it, here's what happened. They go to the thing in Berlin.
Right.
Trying to buy the plutonium from random guys. And the apostles show up. They kidnap Ving Rhames and, you know, do the whole hold the gun to the head kind of thing. And in that fake out, they grab the plutonium. Now the bad guys have the plutonium, and they're going to set off the bombs. And it turns out that, wait, no, they're not doing that. They took the plutonium to threaten to blow up things so they would trade the plutonium for Solomon Lane, who's in jail, and being bounced around the world answering, which made sort of no sense. Like,
yeah, well, I think what happened was that he used to be a British agent.
Right.
But he was captured somewhere else by Americans. And so, like, nobody claimed that they had him under their jurisdiction. They kept bouncing him from place to place.
You know, he was captured in London. I just watched Rogue Nation the other day. The end of that movie ends in London.
Okay.
So they put him in that glass box filled with the gas, and presumably they take him back to MI6 and they say, here's your guy back. He's the one causing all this mayhem.
But they don't do that because he's not in London in this movie.
No, he's like on like a, like a worldwide apology tour.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about.
I mean, I get it. It's sort of a way to make him mobile such that you could grab him in the story, but it also doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, okay, fine. Anyway, so the whole thing is that they want to grab Solomon to, so they can get the plutonium back from the bad guys. And they do, but it's, you know, Ethan, he's such a genius, this guy. You know, there's a line in Rogue Nation that Alec Baldwin says to the British Prime Minister where he goes on for like what seems like a minute and a half of just one sentence describing what kind of a Superman Ethan Hunt is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of ridiculous. You know, like, he basically says, like, there's nothing you can do. You could never stop him. He is the living embodiment of destiny. And I was like, this is a little much. It just, it's so, and that's, but that's sort of what they've built this franchise around, a character who's basically invincible. Because he, like, he gets hurt and it's kind of funny, and he makes that, you know, that Tom Cruise, like, cock your head to the side, raise one eyebrow, and kind of sort of half shrug look whenever sort of something doesn't go quite right. But, like, he's, he's never going to die.
Well, we knew that.
Right. And we'll come back to that, because I have a gripe to gripe with something related to the writing of these movies. But anyway, so then they get the guy, and then now they have to run around with him, keep him alive. Yeah?
Yeah.
What else was there?
Henry Cavill's character ends up throwing a wrench and trying to blame Hunt for being John Lark secretly, which doesn't work. And he uses the confusion to free Solomon Lane and then use the plutonium to blow up a water supply. The end.
So there's no like sort of heisty thing in this movie, is there? Like big sneaking, like big sort of set piece where they have to break into the unusual thing. And there's like a few small things like that. A couple switcheroos with identity here or there.
The big heist one that's not, it takes place as the motorcycle chase, is to get the guy out of the van. Because he says to him, they think he's the villain, Ethan Hunt. And Ethan Hunt is like, yeah, of course, we'll just get the guy out of the van. We'll murder all the cops. No big deal. And you know he's not going to do that.
Right.
So he has to like plan some other escape where they can get the guy out of the van and not kill any policemen and people and stuff like that. And that's what they do. It's just not interesting. Like you see it in the trailers for one. They knock the thing into the river. They cut him out, put him on the boat. And they have to take motorcycles to get away from the cops. Like they split up and they to confuse the other henchmen so that they don't shoot any cops. Okay, I guess.
Yeah.
And then the end scene where they have to get the detonator and defuse the bombs, but they can't get the detonator until the bombs start counting down.
Yeah, that was just a hilarious thing where it's like, how could we make this ridiculously complicated to the point where it could only end, you know, at the last possible second.
Yeah.
And I think I enjoyed that part of the movie the best, was the helicopter chase.
Because
It, you know, it showcased everything that's great about the action sequences in these movies and about the character of Ethan Hunt, in that he's always successful, but never, you know, it's never perfect. It doesn't always go perfectly for him. You know, that goes back to the beginning, like the first movie they did, where like they get the knock list in that, but they doesn't go, you know, according to plan. You know, same thing with the end of that film, with the chase on top of the train car. Like that's, he's just making that up as he goes along, trying to figure out how to, it's just by sheer force of will and physical strength is he able to accomplish these specific tasks.
Yeah, well, that's always been their their best strength in these movies when they have something like that, where here's the plan and we either tell you or we don't what it's going to be, and you watch them have to change it on the fly. You know, how do we use our smarts and our training to get out of this so that it works out in our favor? And if all you're doing is stunts and set pieces, well, it's not that he's using his smarts. He's just using his survival instinct. You know, like, I have to ram this helicopter into that helicopter because he doesn't have a gun. Like, well, I guess that's the other option.
Yeah.
The third option is to quit.
It's just balls to the wall at that point. Like, I either do this and kill myself in the process, or, you know, these 9 billion people will die, kind of thing. And the thing that,
yeah.
So you had pointed out to me a YouTube video a few days ago where this guy was dissecting two scenes from these movies, the one from One and one from Rogue Nation. And his point was that the one from Mission Impossible 1 was better in terms of, like, the heist movie aspect of it, that scene. Because they each had a scene like that. Here's a thing, we have to go in there and get it. And it's really hard for us to sneak in there and get it. And doesn't really matter what it was, but that's the basic setup. And the guy goes into a really great sort of breakdown of how these things work, and he's got names for stuff that I can't recall. But his basic point was that the reason that the heist scene works better in Mission Impossible 1 is that you don't know everything that's going to happen. And the flaw in Mission Impossible 5, Rogue Nation, is that you know exactly what Ethan has to do and pretty much what he's going to do. And even if he wants to change, like, there's a few wrenches thrown into the scenario, basically the same thing has to get achieved. And you know exactly how it has to happen. And in the end, he does it. He just dies trying to get out of the tank of water. And the other girl has to jump in there and get him. And, you know, shock him back to life, whatever it was. And it occurred to me that the thing is that because this is essentially a superhero movie and he can't die, the interesting thing doesn't become whether or not they are successful in their endeavor. The interesting thing is how they are successful.
Right.
And so you can throw enough, you know, monkey wrenches into the thing as you want, but if you tell the audience essentially what they're going to do from point A to point Z, then you're going to make the whole thing essentially boring because you're just watching something play out that you were already aware of.
Well, same with action scenes.
Yeah.
You know, at no point do I ever wonder if James Bond is going to get out of it. Yeah, he's going to get out of it. And unless you're 14 and you've never seen an action film before, you're just waiting. Like, okay, like, they're going to get it. I mean, they set it up at the end of this film that Henry Cavill is this giant beefcake of a man, and he has to beat up 4'1", you know, Tom Cruise. And that's okay. Like, maybe they'll do something different. Like, but they don't. They just slug each other until one of them gets knocked off the cliff.
Yeah.
So even there, I was like, oh, I thought maybe he'd, like, at least can't kick dirt in his eyes, do something. Like, you should be outmatched. You know, even in Tomorrow Never Dies, when he fights that just enormous German guy, he traps a rocket on his foot. Like, he has to cheat.
Yeah, but yeah, he doesn't win the conventional way.
Yeah, like, he was, like, stabbing him with a knife, and the German guy was just standing there. I'm like, okay, how's he going to get out of this one? But they don't do anything like that in this film.
Yeah, and what was interesting was that, like, so going back and watching Rogue Nation, there's that, you know, the big set piece where he's in the tank of water trying to get the data card or whatever. And that was less interesting than a later scene where they find out that the thing they stole is actually they call it a red box. It's a secret, you know, digital vault filled with all this money that Lane is trying to get. And the only one that can open it is the Prime Minister of the UK. So there's this, I thought, really great scene where they trick Alec Baldwin, who is still not here, to go to London and talk to the Prime Minister, and they run it, and then he runs into Chief Atley, I think the character's name is, of MI6, and there's this whole scene where they're talking, and he gives that ridiculous description of Ethan Hunt, and it turns out that Ethan Hunt is Atley. He's done the whole mask thing. So there's a whole thing happening that you weren't aware of, and Hunt pulls the mask off, and it's like, and that's kind of fun. Like, that's what's missing from a lot of Rogue Nation, especially the underwater bit, where you just know everything and that's supposed to happen. And in almost all of Fallout, where there's no big thing happening where you're not clued into it. You're always aware. Even like the one that could be, if you're an idiot, is the opening one where they have that weirdo scientist chained to a hospital bed, and the news is saying that three big cities have been destroyed. It turns out, no, it's not really Wolf Blitzer, it's Simon Pegg, and that kind of thing. And like,
I mean, you had to be an idiot
to know that wasn't actually what was going on. And for half a second, I was like, huh, I wonder if they really did that. Like, really kind of take it that far in their little Mission Impossible universe to blow up three cities and kill millions of people. But no.
Well, also the same with, okay, so like Henry Cavill's character, where it's supposed to be a surprise that he's the bad guy, even though this would have to be the first movie you ever saw, ever, to think that he was a good guy. And you didn't notice as early as I did, but they gave you the clue right away that he's not good when he gives Angela Bassett the cell phone, and he says, I think it's Ethan Hunt. Ethan Hunt's the bad guy. And he's like, this is the phone we pulled off the real John Lark. And it's fixed because in the previous scene when he beat up John Lark, he destroyed his phone and laptop because he's such like a brute.
Yeah.
I'm sitting going, oh, he's giving her a fake phone. He's the bad guy. Well, okay. And then the whole rest of the movie, he just stands in the background until he betrays them. It's like, was that supposed to be a surprise?
Yeah. Like
I didn't even blink. I didn't blink once. I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. No, you knew he was going to be Henry Cavill, for all his beef cakiness, is not a good actor.
No, he's not a great actor.
No. I mean, he
was, I'm not sure what he was supposed to be doing in this. Because, okay, so like in the very beginning, he comes across, like, he plays this, like, I'm a big guy and I get things done, things bigly. You know, I reload my arms, for God's sakes. And like, he smashes a guy with the computer, and Hunt just looks at him like, what did you do that for? He goes, oh, I knocked him out, didn't I? He goes, yeah, well, you just destroyed the machine we need. So if they had played that he was dumb and big, you'd be like, okay, turns out he's really betraying them. But then he never does that the rest of the movie. He becomes this like silent, I'm here to watch you kind of guy. Like, I'm an observer. Just do what you normally would do. You know, don't, I'll sit here with my clipboard and check the boxes and, I don't know. So, like, he kept changing throughout the movie. Then he became a lunatic at the end. I was like, this is very odd.
Yeah, no, his character was wildly inconsistent. Mm-hmm. Like, and he was so ridiculous in the beginning that you kind of, like, I couldn't take him seriously. It's like when they do the Halo jump, and Hunt's like, okay, this is what you got. And he's about to give him the entire rundown of this insanely dangerous thing that they're about to actually do. And the guy's like, fuck it, I'm going. And he just runs off a plane. Like, I'm not willing to believe that person would rise to any position of prominence in any organization whatsoever, even if he could kill anybody if he wanted to with just his arms.
Yeah.
It was just so stupid. Like, I could see him in that bathroom scene. Okay, so he's like destroying the tech might have been part of the goal. And that's kind of a good cover for that. Like, if Hunt has the magic laptop that makes faces, which is really what that was, which and the guy's cell phone, then like, all right, fine. So if your whole thing is you're a big tough guy and you make it look like the destruction of the, you know, specific tech is, you know, just a byproduct of your collateral damage. That's kind of clever. You know, if you're playing it out like a brute, but your brutishness is actually carefully designed to destroy specific things that are benefiting your opponent, okay, fine. But that's not how it comes across. It comes across like he's just a lunatic. And then you're right. Then he just doesn't do anything for the second, third of the movie.
Yeah.
Just kind of sits there. And then he yells at, and then they get one good fuck in this movie.
Yeah.
So.
So here's my overall disappointment with, because the movie's fine. I was like, yeah, this is okay. It's not the worst movie I've ever seen. The action is good. I remember when they did Mission Impossible 2, and I didn't see it because it got terrible reviews, and I was like in college or high school or whatever. And they were like, oh, yeah, Tom Cruise is in it again. I was like, he is? Oh, okay. I guess it's going to be the same guy. And then by the time they did the third movie with him, I was a little disappointed that they hadn't picked somebody new. Like, it's supposed to be a team and all over the world doing all kinds of stuff, you know? And they were still focusing on this one person. And like you said, they gave him a wife. Like he had that became his personal life became much more integral to the plot.
In the third movie, yeah.
Which they're kind of like upset. Like they kind of keep brushing off like, well, we can't have him save the world and love this woman at the same time. You know, so 4, 5, 6 movies in, this movie was just, it felt very joyless and I'm not going to say running on fumes. It just, here's the same guy. We know everything about him. We know he puts the mission ahead of everything. You know, he's been disavowed 5 times or, you know, and they're constantly shitting on the IMF, even though it does all the work, you know, and it always is successful. I like Tom Cruise a lot. But you've sucked everything out of this series with the same guy every single time. Just pick a new person, start fresh, maybe a woman. You know, it's very different for the women in these movies than it is for the men.
Yes, I will say though that they don't James Bond this up the way like with the ladies in the same way. So like. Rebecca Ferguson, who plays Ilsa Faust, who's the pseudo love interest, but they're not really like, it's not hot and heavy. It's just, you know, she's there. They're tough, but they're not like ridiculously tough. Like this 98-pound British lady, I know, is not taking down someone who's like 6.5 feet tall. So like the fight sequences with her and, you know, all that, they're done in such a way to show how would a woman of this build be able to defend herself against someone twice her size. It's actually pretty well done, I think. The fight sequences, I mean, we're being really nitpicky about plot and, you know, character and story and structure, you know, things that make movies. But the stuff that actually sells movies is exquisite in this film. It really is. The fight sequences are all great. The car chases are all good. Underwater stuff is always fun. They jump out of a fucking airplane. I mean,
it is, but then you're not watching it to be entertained. Like,
so what was the thing about the film you thought you were going to say?
Well, you listen to that weekly substandard podcast with those ninnies who go on and on, and they were talking about 2001.
Yeah,
and. And the one guy was saying, like, I hate this movie. It's stupid. It's a stupid movie. However, certain parts of it are shot beautiful and well executed and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just a shame that the movie itself is so dumb. And I'm sitting there nodding along. Like, I watched that in college once. Like, I got it from the library, sat down. I was like, I have to watch this. It's supposed to be a classic. And I wanted to gouge my eyes out. I don't care how good looking the movie was. It was idiotic and stupid, like most Stanley Kubrick movies. I think I find them impossible to watch, and I just can't sit here and be like, well, even though there was no plot, you know, the action scenes were good. Yes, the action scenes were good, but they're also boring because I've seen this exact same thing 6 times, and I know he's going to get out of it. I know his wife's not going to die. You know, all he has left is his intensity for the mission and the need to save his wife. So it's sort of just redundant at this point. And I think, like, if they just pick someone new, that might revitalize things a little, like, get some of the fun back in, someone who enjoys being there. You know, like in the 4th one, they had Simon Pegg's character, who was his first time in the field, and all he wanted to do was wear a mask. Like, he was excited to do that. And the gag was that nobody got to wear a mask. But, you know, in this film, it's old hat for him. You know, he wears the masks almost the whole time. And, you know, he's still Simon Pegg, so he makes jokes. But, you know, it's not like we're having a good time doing this.
Yeah, no, they've definitely... They're limping, as it were. But I mean, we talked before about, not today, but previous days, about how I had problems with things like, you know, the Avengers Infinity War, because they were doing things that were kind of outside of the normal way you make a movie, mm-hmm. trying to tie in 37 characters into one film. And they did it, and it, you know, that was as successful as you could be at that. But that was what they were trying to do, not trying to make a regular movie. And you said, like, if once you realize that they're not trying to make a regular movie, it becomes a lot more bearable to watch. And I'm like, okay, fine, but I still wanted to see a regular movie. And that's where we are now with a lot of these things, is that, like, they're not really making a regular film. You don't make a movie by saying, I want to jump out of an airplane and drive a boat into the Seine and do all these, you know, specific things. Now, write me a story around all that. That can be a fun exercise intellectually, and I certainly, you know, applaud people who work within boundaries and certain frameworks to create art, but that's not how you're going to make a coherent movie.
The movie's perfectly coherent.
Well, I guess coherent isn't, but it's not how you're going to make a movie that, you know, maintains fidelity of character and plot and story as you go through it, because you're too worried about doing certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what they wanted to do. They did not care to make a movie where Henry Cavill's character had a consistent persona the entire time. It wasn't important to them. What was more important to them was, you know, getting that IMAX camera to film the entire helicopter chase such that we can put it in an IMAX movie theater, yeah. Which they did, and it looked great. And I actually saw it in IMAX, and I, you know, people usually say, well, you know, it cuts back and forth between IMAX and regular, and that only happened at the end where it was, like, obvious, like, this scene was shot regularly. This scene was shot in IMAX. But, yeah, I mean, they just didn't want to make that kind of movie. They didn't care enough. Because, we don't do this for a living. We comment on it as a hobby. So somebody on the production staff must have went, you know, Henry Cavill stops talking for about an hour in the middle of this movie. No one noticed this? Were we the only ones? I doubt that. But they didn't care.
Yeah, well, I think it's more than that. I think it's, you know, it's also just, we want to do these stunts, and we're trying to make them different than the last few, but I think they're going about it the wrong way. I think they're going in the wrong direction. They're focusing on things that are less interesting, you know, to me personally, than what I would find interesting. I mean, it's not even like I have this love of the old TV show and I'm pissed they don't do things like that. Like, I don't care. And it doesn't have to be exactly like the first Mission Impossible. But it's also, each one is a successfully less like, you know, I guess that's fine.
Did you happen to see any of those ridiculous, like, interview trailers that they have? I don't know if you know what I mean, but, like, it's a trailer for a movie where you don't really watch a bunch of cutscenes or clips of it smashed together. You watch interviews with the director and the actors, and it just felt like that's what like every writer's room session was about this movie. Like the whole thing was just to do that really shticky thing that they all talk about in those little interviews as well. This one is going to be better and bigger, and they never say it's going to be different. And that's, you know, probably a marketing no-no, is to say how different this is going to be, because people generally want this to see the same thing all the time. You know, like I have friends from Texas, and they always used to laugh when they came to New York and said that, like, you know, in New York, everything is the best. And you're looking for the best, you know, sandwich, the best pizza. And in Texas, it's always the biggest. So with no, you know, reference at all to quality. So basically, it's just those two ideas from Texas and New York smashed into one concept, better and bigger. Even though the two things aren't related to each other whatsoever. But for Hollywood, they are, you know, like, better than a guy hanging from a ceiling in a really quiet room is a guy, you know, jumping out of a plane at 25,000 feet and, you know, or swimming in an underwater, like, whirlpool. Or, you know, like, it's just, it's never about we're going to do it differently, we're going to take this approach to it, we're going to, you know, it's, they never talk about that. They don't want. They don't want to, and they'd be flayed alive by their marketing guys if they ever did. Because like they're not. Like, they're making a thing. It's a Mission Impossible movie, and they've. What's interesting is this has kind of evolved over the last. Well, I shouldn't say it's kind of evolved. It evolved very quickly from one to two into this is, a pretty straightforward spy movie with a. Some fantastical elements to it, and certainly some action sequences. To, you know, a John Woo film where there's doves flying for no reason, and, you know, people jumping, you know, out of buildings or what have you, and then it just became a thing because that was Tom Cruise's, you know, insane personal shtick, which is like, I will push myself beyond what. The insurance companies will let me do just because I think it's more authentic or more this, or, you know, they're just chasing that all the time now. And that's fine if you like that sort of thing. And I, to an extent, do. But for 2.5 hours to watch that, it's just like, this is a long movie.
Yeah, it felt long a few times, too.
It felt long a lot of the time. I mean, to be fair, I did drink a soda. And they don't sell small sodas in movie theaters, so you have to get the big one.
You have to empty out what's in there first and then drink the soda.
Well, it's,
you know, like, don't drink something and then have a huge soda. Don't, you're just making it worse.
I thought I had. I didn't have to go.
Yeah.
Till I did.
I have to go now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, anything you really liked?
I loved the helicopter bit.
I didn't. I thought it was dull.
Oh, at that point, yeah. Like, you kind of have to divorce yourself and think about it independent of the rest of the 2.5 hours that you saw to say, okay, that bit was great. And if they had done that and that alone, I might have been okay with that. Like, the Halo jump was a waste of time.
Yeah, I don't even remember it.
Right, yeah. Like, it informed you about the insanity of the Henry Cavill character poorly. And they just jumped onto a building. Like, why do they have to do that at 30,000 feet? That didn't stick in my head as to why they had to do that exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But the helicopter thing, you know, made sense. It had tension to it. It not a lot of tension, but just enough tension because, you know, they're not going to actually blow up the bombs. But. Yeah, so that part was good. I did like the fight scene in the bathroom. It wasn't great.
Well, I thought that was the best scene.
Yeah.
Because it was a little unusual. Like, you know, it's two guys and they're getting their asses kicked.
I think that was what was most interesting about it was this pretty slight Asian fella.
Yeah, well, that's one of those examples where it's like they have to cheat. They have to shoot the guy. The whole time they're trying to just knock him out because they need his face.
Yeah.
And they end up having to cheat, and Henry Cavill blows his head off. through this ridiculous scene, and they trashed, you know, the pipes and the mirrors and stuff like that. Whereas like the helicopter scene was just them flying in a helicopter back and forth until Ethan finally hits them. Like it was like, oh, he's trying to hit us, but it's hard to tell because of the camera angles and the way it was shot. I was like, I guess he's getting closer. And then in the last second, like all of a sudden you see him veer into him. I'm like, oh, okay, he hit him. You know,
I mean, what I appreciate about the helicopter chase was that there's no way it would work. Like, it's sort of insane that it goes, it just, it's insanity upon insanity upon ridiculousness. And it becomes almost a farce, but it sort of teeters up to that point and then stops. Like, at no point should this make, you know, any sense. It's just, it reminds me of a lot of, like, you know, mid-70s Bond movies, you know, where it's, you know, like, it's one ridiculous thing after the other. In this case, it was one intensely ridiculous thing that was loud and violent and dangerous for 20 minutes. And it's one of those things, like, you either can do that a little bit and have everyone go, well, that seems a little bit silly. Or you could do it for 20 fucking minutes and everyone go, wow, you know, I'm still watching this. Like, at some point, I just kind of, I think it was when the two fuselages were, like, wedged on top of each other in a rock face, sliding down towards each other. I was like, this is insane. Like, laughing to myself. And, like, and that was fun. At that point, you're like, this is, you know, this is fun. But it's an independent thing from the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not part of the movie in a sense. You're like, once you kind of laugh at yourself like that, then you're out of the film. You know, you're just watching, you know, just them to see what they could come up with and get away with. But it has nothing to do with anything. It was just, you know, independently amusing to watch. But as far as like stuff that goes on in the film, I mean, yeah, everything was fine. Like, back to my first impression, it was fine.
Yeah, it was fine.
I did appreciate that Alec Baldwin's hair was a bit more tamed in this film. Like, I went back and watched Rogue Nation, and, you know, his character in Rogue Nation is trying to shut down the IMF, and he plays the director of the CIA. And, like, George H.W. Bush used to be the director of the CIA. So that's the kind of guy that actually runs the CIA. And I get this is Hollywood. That's fine. But he has this insane haircut that was so distracting to me. It was like a boy band haircut where it's, like, all kind of short. But then in the front, it sort of spikes up, you know, kind of like a, you know, it's, you know, like an anime character, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it and I'm going, I can't take him seriously with that haircut. There's just no way.
I know I'm tired of, you know, they have these fights between the two branches, you know, the CIA and the MIF. They hate each other, or IMF, I should say, for no reason that I can see. And she even says, like, well, you guys use a scalpel and we use a sledgehammer. Get things done. I'm like, guys, these people have, like, a ridiculous track record. They're really good at what they do. And to not give them the help and the benefit of the doubt, it's just annoying now, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like what they're doing with the Bond movies, where they're like, you know, Bond is a relic of an ancient time, and, you know, we're going to use big data to solve our issues now. And I'm like, yeah, but, like, it's pretty successful so far. I mean, I don't see what the complaints are, but like that there would be interagency friction is not implausible. It just you can't set up these guys to be like super spies and then have them, you know,
it's just
be criticized by other people. And yeah, and it's been done a lot, man.
It's just done so like the intensity is like where he says, like, we only have to do this one thing and we'll crack the case, and she's like, no, I can't wait anymore. What? Why? Why now? Like, why is that suddenly a problem? And even when they say, like, there's at one point where they catch Solomon Lane, And they call up Angela Bassett and they say, we have him. We're going to bring him in. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. She's like, no, I'm sending in my team right now to take him and do what I want. What? That's stupid. Like, that's stupid.
Yeah, they're trying to manufacture some tension there. It didn't really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like that. It's just annoying. Wonder what Alec Baldwin would say.
I do wonder that. You know, he's no longer in the franchise. They've killed him.
Yes. Sorry. Spoiler alert.
Will they make a seventh one of these movies?
No, sure.
I mean, he'll be 60 years old. 70. I mean, he does not age. He is ageless.
Yeah.
It's all that kombucha and placenta he eats.
Mm-hmm. Virgins he sacrifices.
Yes. So, who knows? I don't. But, you know, someone I'm sure does. If you want to share your thoughts about Mission Impossible Fallout, you can tweet us at 3DrinksInPod or also on Instagram at 3DrinksInPod. You can email us, 3DrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. Click subscribe. Tell your friends. Leave a review. Yeah, I think that's everything.
I think that's it.
I hope so. Okay. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Yep, take care.
Bye.
You can't fight the friction. So.
Top secret agents.